have, you know, chicken farms that Israeli companies run, and settlers that have set up fantastic stone houses and communities fenced off have chickens. Let me put this way: chickens in Israel, in Israeli companies, you know, farm, have far more access to water and electricity than Palestinian villages and people. And checkpoints, 810 kilometer long wall, and it's not just for you know, security purposes. It is actually, the UN said it in 2005, the wall, 810 kilometer long wall, has been the prime driver behind mass deprivation, in other words, mass poverty of Palestinian people. And so it's rather frightening that Ramallah, you know, it's a thriving, you know, the city, bubble, but you know, the locals tell me that, you know, the Israeli IDF and security agency will come in and do anything they want, and Palestinian Authority is completely helpless, and they cannot do nothing. They cannot protect the Palestinian people, even in Ramallah. Forget about West Bank and other places. Land confiscation. You know, we came very close to being tear gassed by the IDF because we were supporting the you know, farm family that have been evicted after their farm has been confiscated in Jerusalem, UNESCO World Heritage agricultural areas. And so the, you know, we, the Hebrew-speaking local colleagues in Jerusalem area who were with us told us that we need to vacate the place because the IDF is going to start firing tear gas and stun guns.
So, Zaini, finally, we want to turn to what's going on in Burma. If you could respond to the new UN Human Rights report and their warning about what's going on in Burma.
Yeah, I mean, the UN Human Rights report cover, you know, well, 1 year period since, you know, spring of 2023. What it says, what it paints is an extremely, you know, disturbing picture of Burma, you know, descending into this human rights abyss. You know, if you're living there, it's a complete living hell. You know, 3 million people being displaced by civil war between the army on one hand and various, you know, the pro-democracy or pro-ethnic liberation armed groups. You know, then we got hit by the typhoon, you know, over the last 10 days, and another 700,000 people, they're displaced and dispossessed. And so the only problem is that in the past, the you know, the Burmese military, the junta, has been the number one or sole perpetrator of egregious human rights crime. But since the coup 3 years ago, we have a mushrooming of you know, armed organizations, you know, in the name of like a pro-democracy movement, and they join hands with different ethnic or ethno-nationalist organizations. And so there are organizations such as Arakan Army, which represent the Buddhist Rakhine in Western Myanmar. Now they are
We have 15 seconds,
committing genocide. Yeah.
We want to thank you so much for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to cover what's happening in Burma and also in Gaza and the West Bank. Meng Zarni, Burmese dissident, human rights activist, scholar of genocide, co-founder of the Forces of Renewal for Southeast Asia, speaking to us from Kent. Very happy belated birthday to Sam Alkoff. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresina, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election will take place on Saturday, September 21st at 1 p.m. at the Show Bar in Southeast Portland. The meeting will include a state of the station presented by KBOO's Board of Directors, as well as opportunities for members to meet the candidates running in the board election. Final votes will be cast and the results of the election will be announced at the end of the meeting. Again, that's KBOO Community Radio's annual meeting and board election on Saturday, September 21st at 1 p.m. at the Show Bar, 1300 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. Ballots and more information can be found at kboo.fm/board24.
Wake up, KBOO listeners. It's time to support local, community-based media this fall by donating and becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give. When you contribute now up until September 21st, your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $11,000 thanks to listeners like you. Double the impact, double the fun, so go now to kboo.fm/give.
The following program is a rebroadcast. Dates, times, and events mentioned in the following program have already occurred. Thank you for tuning in to KBOO Portland.
Keeping it real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest today is Randall Wyatt. He's the founder and director of Taking Ownership PDX. I'm so stoked to have you here. They help renovate and revive Black-owned homes where the owners have requested their help, with an emphasis on enabling Black homeowners to age in place, generate wealth, and simultaneously deter predatory investors and realtors to deflect the gentrification process. Their motto is, let's build, literally. I'm going to be right back, and we're going to have Randall on the mic. Randall Wyatt, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm so excited to have you here. People who listen to this show know that I complain about real estate speculation constantly, and it to me, it's one of the worst things that's happening in our area, in our region. You could say in our nation, on the West, whatever. But to me, that one thing, if we could figure it out, and we're not going to, because it's a profit thing. Anyway,
yeah.
Good morning, Randall. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
You can tell I talk about this too much. I rant about real estate speculation. Talk about Taking Ownership PDX. How does it work? What do you do?
Sure, yeah. So we're a community-based and reparation-based organization that operates through three of our programs. So we have our main program, which is the Home Improvement Program, and that's where we raise money, and we use that money to hire contractors and vendors that are licensed, bonded, insured, professional, who will do quality work for Black homeowners that request services. So we hire, you know, whoever's right for those services, and they do the work, and it's free of charge to the Black homeowners as a form of reparations. And then we have our community impact program. That's where we utilize volunteers to do seasonal maintenance, like landscaping work, basic stuff, you know, basic cleanup jobs, sometimes prep work for our contractors and vendors. They'll do exterior painting jobs, stuff like that. And then we have our small business financial assistance program, where we are helping small businesses, you know, keep their businesses in an increasing market in areas where they've built, you know, customers and in community. So that's how we operate.
Really quickly, I want you to define reparations.
Reparations, well, as you know, It's a form of equity, you know. It's repairing what has been done to a community that's been for hundreds of years economically excluded, oppressed, and put at a disadvantage, while other populations have, a particular population, as we all know, has been able to thrive and have all those opportunities. So there's a huge disparity, and in order for there to be a chance of leveling the playing field, you have to find equity, and that's what reparations is. It's a form of repairing, however you want to do it. Mine's through free repairs and financial assistance for small business owners.
I want to talk about a little bit later. I want to talk about how that, the big picture on that, how it impacts everyone, because I suspect that there's a ripple effect. But I want to come back to the beginning and say, well, what gave you the idea for taking ownership?
Sure, yeah. So a lot of it came from my studies at Portland State University. Actually, I was getting my degree in social science with a double minor in Black Studies and Sociology. So I'm studying, you know, white supremacy in depth, the plight of African Americans, and I'm learning, like, white supremacy is very much predicated on land ownership. It's taking land, it's keeping land, it's excluding other populations from getting land.
Might even be stealing land. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Absolutely, a lot of it is stealing land, and when we talk about the history of this country. So I just kind of, you know, and I've been a firm believer in reparations. I think that's the only way we're going to really you know, repair what has happened in this country. So I just can't, you know, I found the opportunity at the start of the BLM movement. After George Floyd was murdered, I saw a lot of people came to me and were asking how to be stronger supporters for the Black community and other marginalized communities. And I was like, here's my time to think of this model of platform of reparations in the form of helping Black homeowners stay in their homes in areas that are gentrifying. And I just felt like I knew repair was a big, you know, a big aspect of how people get displaced.
Just really quickly, walking back, you're studying at Portland State. I love hearing that an institution, big institutions, are actually planting the seeds of concrete projects that make the community better. Just like, who at Portland State really inspired this? I know this is the beginning, but I have to know right now.
You know, and I also experienced this. I've been impacted by gentrification. I've been displaced. I just didn't understand how gentrification worked until I did a lot of my own studying. But there's a few professors that stick out to me, Ethan Johnson and Kristen Teagan, who I have the pleasure of actually collaborating with now with her capstone class. Yeah, those were two people that, you know, she has a racial equity in Oregon class that really made me, or educated me on what was going on in Oregon in particular, you know. So I know I'm not going to be able to save the whole nation by myself, but if I can learn enough about my community and figure out how, you know, a solution, that's kind of how it came about. That's how the idea came about.
I find that I know that this sounds like a circus act, but we all stand on each other's shoulders, and that's how it works. So can you quantify the economic damage that redlining and racism in financial dealings have in our local community? How bad is it? And what's the long-term impact on families?
You know, I don't have all the data, but anytime you put a population that's already been economically excluded and oppressed for hundreds of years and force them to live in a concentrated area that isn't really of their choice, they might want to live in other areas, and then you don't invest in that area, like they're not able to get loans to maintain their homes, to upgrade their homes, to build value, you're not getting business loans, and then you leave them vulnerable to predatory developers. So as soon as they want to take over that area to develop, quote unquote, the area, they're now at a disadvantage, and they can use things like blight, where they're like, oh, your house isn't up to code, the maintenance isn't up to our standards, so we're going to seize this home, displace you, and then we'll go ahead and decimate your community with I-5.
And they can be the financial institutions. It can also be the people that run the municipality, like the people that run the city, actually. So
absolutely,
there's layers of they, and those layers kind of glom together and make it a heavier impact, I think.
Absolutely. I mean, the city allows the policies that the banks follow, that they don't have to loan to these people, they don't have to give mortgages to these people, and yeah, it over time you're losing homes, so you're not able to pass that down to different generations. You know, you're not able to build value, you're in, and then all of a sudden you find affluent people moving into your neighborhood, and there's a huge disparity of wealth, and you're getting pushed out because the cost of living is going up. Or even what I'm seeing a lot and what we're combating directly is that affluent people are complaining about the aesthetics of their black and brown neighbors and calling the city on them, which the city's putting nuisance fines and liens on those homes, which further contributes to economic insecurity, you know, financial insecurity, and leaves them vulnerable for predatory developers and taking undermarket offers on their homes.
I love this conversation so much because I think about this all the time. And just to follow up on what you just said, in some ways, you know, at bottom line, I would have said, well, why don't the banks lend to everybody? Isn't it their profit? Don't they make money off of everybody? But I mean, at that point, and this is not a conspiracy, but at that point, you have to look at how the banking as an industry actually is a tool of white supremacy straight up, because otherwise, absolutely, you know, we would all be making money. And the other thing that I wanted to say about it is because the upshot is that in this capitalist society, money money that flows in the financial systems is kind of like blood that flows through a body. And if there's a place where those financial resources are not allowed to flow, that limb is going to drop off. And that's kind of what's happened. I mean, to me, you look at society, it's a body, it's alive,
absolutely,
right? More or less sentient. And when but at a certain point, you could just see, well, this is a society, this is a community, but look, that whole part over there doesn't work at all. And look at how it impacts the schools to prisons pipeline. Either you're going to go to school or you're going to go to prison. Like, but I'm a privileged person, I don't have to deal with that. But that's not true. I think everybody has to deal with it.
Absolutely. And I talk about that often, is how racism impacts white people. There's a great book called The Sum of Us by Heather McGee that explains it in depth. And it's, you know, and I think that's one of the ways to really get through to white people why you don't want racism, why you don't want segregation, why, you know, because they're, you know, it's their benefit to keep certain populations down. And, you know, it's expensive to be poor, and it gives them an opportunity whenever they want to do something in a certain area, they're going to take the path of least resistance. And so that's why they're able to build Legacy Emmanuel when they did, and the Memorial Coliseum. So that's why that's my idea, or why I think they weren't investing in those, but also just pure hatred for a population for whatever reason, brainwashing. You know, racism is a form of conditioning. And at one point they felt like black people weren't even a full human being. So,
oh, that would be the Supreme Court. Hi, this is a beautiful Thursday morning, and our guest, this is Keeping It Real, and I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest today, Randall Wyatt, founder and director of Taking Ownership PDX. They help renovate and revive Black-owned homes that have requested their help, where the owners have requested their help, with an emphasis on enabling Black homeowners to age in place, generate wealth, and simultaneously deter predatory investors and realtors to deflect the gentrification process. Their motto, let's build. Literally. Okay, I use the S word, and it is Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And the thing, Randall, I'm old now. I'm old. Oh, I feel so tired too. But for 40 years, I've been out here covering some of these issues, and I thought we were making the world a better place. And when people talk now about the Supreme Court, why they've become so corrupt, I have to actually stop and say, no, this was always corrupt.
Always.
If we ever thought that, I don't know, for example, Roe versus Wade, or I don't know, like making it possible for Brown versus the Board of Education, those were the exceptions. And now you see this kind of, it's almost like it's fascism in my world is a marriage of industry and government. And that's what's happened. That's what this whole country always was. But you see that in a big way now. And I saw something in your space, and it was PDX Housing Solidarity Project. Mm-hmm. What is that?
Oh, yeah. So shortly after I founded Taking Ownership, a woman named Annie Moss reached out to me, who is part of a radical group of allies called Resource Generation. And she owned multiple properties. And one of the properties was in the historically black Albina neighborhood that is no longer much of a black community. And she wanted to transfer that home to black ownership because, you know, that's the work that you're doing is reparations. So she ended up, long story short, ended up selling me this house for what was left on the mortgage, gifting me a large sum of equity. And, you know, we call that wealth redistribution. And I struggle with that word for some reason. And we decided when we were done, like, why stop there? Let's encourage other people to do the same, other allies, other folks who have the means to redistribute. And that's how it was born. So it's a collective of volunteers. We're not an organization. We're not an LLC, a nonprofit, anything, just a collective. We don't touch any of the money. We're more of like a matchmaking service. We have a listserv of 100 and or actually over 200 allies who believe in reparations, who donate money directly to black and indigenous families to help them become mortgage ready and put down payments on homes that are aspiring first time homebuyers.
So who participates with PDX Housing Solidarity Project? Are there other organizations that we can learn about and say, hey, what, they do that too? Or is it individual people? I just want to spread the love right now.
Yeah. So with PDX HSP, we have some partnerships with like NAIA, so that they help us out a lot. You know, diving into that community, African American Alliance for Homeowners, Taking Ownership, of course. Those are some of our partners at this time. But a lot of our donors are individuals, their families, or people that, like, maybe they'll sell their home and they know they gained a bunch of equity off of privilege and they'll donate, you know, part of their equity. Or, you know, some people are giving huge lump sums. Some people are just donating $50 here and there when they can, you know, and it's all helpful.
And to follow up on that really quickly, people are making a donation, but also they're investing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a different kind of investment. You're not going to get a dividend check. What do people get when they invest their resources in your organization and back in our communities like that?
Well, I mean, they get a clear path of reconciliation and justice. This matters to a lot of people. They know the history of this country. They know what maybe their ancestors have done, and this is their chance to reconcile and bring justice and also keep their communities diverse. It's, you know, when you're constantly displacing folks that are marginalized, you find yourself, especially white folks, find themselves in homogenous communities where everybody's the same. You're not learning from different cultures. And that's a beautiful thing. Diversity is a beautiful thing. And that's what you're doing. You're keeping your communities cultured and diverse.
We are talking today with Randall Wyatt. He's the founder and director of Taking Ownership PDX, which is a nonprofit.
Yes, we are.
So if people make a contribution or invest in that, they'll get a tax break or something.
Absolutely.
Like that? Okay, good. I just wanted to put that on the table too.
Yeah.
I want to believe that people listening to this show are people who want to build, literally, people mm-hmm. who want to create a different reality that supports more people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so on one hand, I'm trying to think about what people might need to know to support you. But also, I know that there's people listening who have their own big idea and they might want to start their own project and they might think they're nuts and that's impossible. But it's people like you and other people that we've had as guests on the show who come in and talk about how you did this work,
mm-hmm.
and it plants seeds in so many different ways. My son just got married last week. I'm so excited. He's 33 years old, and he grew up listening to KBOO.
Awesome.
And he's learned all. He was a child, and these kinds of ideas planted in his mind like seeds. And the same thing, other listeners, I know that this is happening with your kids, your teenagers, your little kids.
Yeah.
And
you know what's funny is I actually just created a workshop called Growing Grassroots Movements, and I did it through Oregon Humanities a couple weeks ago, and we had a great feedback on it. So it's something I like what you're saying. I do want to share my story. I want to share the knowledge that I've gained building this plane while flying type of thing. So I'm hoping to take it to some schools and other organizations, whoever, really.
That's fantastic. What's in it? Talk about it.
Oh, sure. I mean, so basically we just kind of start off with my story, and then we go into the steps of growing a grassroots movement from, you know, from day one, sharing the idea on Facebook was what, how I started it. Maybe it was look different to you. Getting the LLC, finding the fiscal sponsor. Once the
LLC is kind of like your bureaucratic structure. Is that okay to wait?
Sure. Yeah. It's a for-profit, just to protect yourself. Right. So you know, if anything happens, they can't go after me personally. They can go after the LLC, and then getting a fiscal sponsor, because it takes some time to get the nonprofit status. So you have a nonprofit representing you that can funnel the donations through. But a lot of that knowledge of taking something that from an idea and building it into an actual tangible, impactful entity.
Delivering your brainchild.
Yeah.
It's a birth. It really is a lot like a birth, too.
Yeah.
You need your prenatal care and all that.
Going through a lot of questions to get your wheels turning, because you might have some great ideas, but a lot of, you know, I have to constantly evolve this based off like new roadblocks and things that just didn't work or things that worked really well, you know. So
when I think, Randall Wyatt, about someone who's stepping up to take the super, it's almost like the idea of reparations is such a, for some people, it's almost like a third rail of an idea. Because this is a racist country. We're like, if you're listening, you already know what I'm talking about. But, and it's funny too about reparations, because I worked at the Scanner newspaper for years and years and years, and Robert Ogletree, who was this brilliant college professor, came and was the keynote speaker at the Scanner newspaper's Martin Luther King breakfast years ago. Mm-hmm. And it was the first time I ever heard anyone talk about it. And he was so brilliant that I know that there's at least 1,000 people who heard about this directly. Reparations. It's about how to, you know, if you don't have an even platform, that means that everybody's getting shoved to one edge every time the boat tips. And it doesn't matter what your background is. Everybody's getting thrown around. And to have such a big idea about something that is so intrinsic to our culture. I just have to look at you and say, when you did this cool workshop with Oregon Humanities, which we love you, Oregon Humanities. I don't know if you're listening right now. But Oregon Humanities, actually, they juggle ideas. They juggle visions, and they put them on the table. Mm-hmm. When you did this project, who showed up? Like, what did you learn from it? I mean, and you've just given one workshop. Am I hearing that right?
Yeah, just one. It's my first time.
Yeah, what did you learn? And who was there?
Oh, yeah, just community members. People from all over the city, the inner city folks. Some people that I've already, you know, follow, taking ownership. Some people I've never met before. And it was beautiful, because it was people of all different eras, different communities that all, you know, because the big part of it was like, what's something that you want to combat? What's a solution you need in your community? So there's all these different communities that are educating me on what they're dealing with, what their solutions are. And so I'm just learning a lot. And that's the beauty of diversity, right? There's just so many different cultures that came in here and shared and were vulnerable enough to share what is on their heart and what, you know, what's on their mind and what they want to do about some of the issues they are facing.
Randall, I know that on one hand, people might think that helping families of African descent one household at a time is just scratching the surface of the need. But is there a ripple effect here? And what does that look like?
Absolutely, there is. One, helping one person is great, too, because that one person, I mean, the feedback we get, the reward for that one person is huge, and they can pass that on and pay it forward. But the big thing is, you know, what I always tell people is, you know, it's the model. The model is huge. And I've been able to be, you know, flown to the East Coast to speak about this work and have a lot of them be over there like, wow, that's really an impactful model you created. How can we implement that here in our communities? And I'm working on a handbook to get that to different community leaders all over the nation to kind of just really explain the model. But yeah, the model itself, and if every, you know, every community in the nation is doing the same work, that's, you know, it's gonna make a huge change nationally. And, you know, that's the goal. But you know, that's, I think that's where the ripple effect really happens. It's building awareness, and it's, you know, inspiring people to also create their own grassroots efforts and build upon other reparations-based and mutual aid-based models.
I want to follow up on that and ask, if you went to the East Coast, like you met people from other places, is this issue hitting everyone the same, or are there nuances that are different by region? Or, I mean, do we have more in common than in opposition? What's happening in other places?
You know, I don't know exactly all other places, but I know gentrification is happening everywhere. And I think it's more egregious here in Portland because we have such a small black community. We are the whitest city, major city in the country. So, you know, a city like Philadelphia, where I went, they have a huge black population, but they're facing it. There's huge wealth disparity. The wealth disparity is nationwide for obvious reasons. So that's going to impact the housing market and what kind of housing black people can get when the market's going up and their wages aren't going up at the same rate as white families and so forth. So it does look different here. You know, how somebody were to implement a model like taking ownership would have to be catered to the needs of their communities, because every community across the nation has different needs.
One of the things that you're making me remember is how, you know, my friends at Earth First, I know I'm bringing this up, this is nutty, but I'm bringing it up. My friends in Earth First, 40 years ago, they used to talk about gentrifying the forest.
Mm.
And that's what the Forest Service was allowing. And so people that built their houses in these places that used to be forest, and now we're seeing that. Now we're seeing that people who, quote, gentrified the forest are all getting burned out from wildfires.
Mm.
There's reasons why private market forces are not actually a great bellwether of how we should live. And I wanted to ask you, so for the people that your organization serves, what are they facing? What's happening to them?
The big thing that they're facing right now is, like I said, they're living in rapidly gentrifying areas where affluent people are moving into their communities that have they make significantly more money than them. And a lot of the black community homeowners, and what I'm seeing, are senior citizens. They're elderly on Social Security. They don't have the funding or even, like, sometimes the physical capabilities to maintain their homes. And they're living alone often because they lost a spouse or something. And the family's moved on because they all grown up. So these affluent folks are moving in and they're complaining about the aesthetics, the maintenance of the homes of their black and brown neighbors, without considering these, you know, financial disparities, and without being compassionate and actually going to their neighbors, getting to know them, figuring out. Nobody wants to live in a busted house, right? Unhealthy house. So instead of actually going over there and seeing, you know, what the problem is, they're calling the city in the Bureau of Development Services, which is completely funded by liens and fines. So it's in a way incentivized, is putting liens and fines that accrue and leave them further in, you know, put them further in debt. They have to take out sometimes predatory subprime, well, at one time subprime and optional arms loans or reverse mortgages, things like that, which put them in more debt. And it just leaves them vulnerable to losing their homes to predatory developers and real estate professionals. And you know, that's one of the big things I'm seeing they're facing.
Following up on that, one of the stories that I worked on at the Scanner, one of the stories that surprised me more than any other story, I think it was in 2002 or 2003, this elderly man called me and said, "We're losing our home. We've lived here for 40 years. And because the contractor didn't pay for his roof shingles, now the roof shingle company gets to foreclose on our house."
Mm-hmm.
And that is a law in Oregon. I don't believe it's ever mm-hmm. been changed. And later the Oregonian did a story on how that affects millionaire homeowners. But in this case, it was a company that that manufactured roofing tiles. The contractor who did the repairs, at the Oregon Construction Contracting Board, like, there are so many pitfalls for families that are vulnerable to racist practices just in getting a roofing gig.
Yep.
You can spend $5,000. These roofing tiles were only worth like $4,000, but the law allowed this company to foreclose on the entire house, which was worth $130,000 or more. And, you know, the family would get that money. But the thing is, at that point, you couldn't buy a new house for that.
Exactly.
So it's not even just the redlining in buying homes, but it's that it's absolutely dangerous for an elderly person to even get a loan to do these repairs because they could lose everything.
Right.
That part blows my mind. And here you are. You're fixing the stuff. I mean, for real?
Yeah.
Right. It's brilliant.
Exactly.
It's brilliant.
That's what we need, you know. You know, that's why I think we've been so popular. Is like there's a lot, you know, there's not a lot of loopholes or a lot of, you know, we just are allocating the funding right from the donors straight to the, you know, community without making them jump through all these hoops to get, you know, access to it, which is getting harder and harder to do as we are getting foundations now to fund us and becoming a nonprofit. But I'm sticking to my mission, and not all money is good money. So, you know, if there's too many stipulations that go against the mission, you know, because that's the whole point. That's what we're trying to do. We got to give them access to this. And so many of our the homeowners we serve are so fearful of taking any kind of loans, or even if there are no interest, or even if they're forgiven after a certain period of time, which I've seen a lot of those, but they're still like, no way. Like, I've seen this before, you know. So that's what the beautiful thing. That's why I wanted to make this so accessible and truly, you know, reparations.
If you just tuned in, this is Keeping It Real. I'm Lisa Loving. Our guest today is Randall Wyatt, founder and director of Taking Ownership PDX. They help renovate and revive Black-owned homes that have requested their help, or the owners have requested their help, with an emphasis on enabling Black homeowners to age in place, generate wealth, and simultaneously deter predatory investors and realtors to deflect the gentrification process. This is straight off their website. We're going to give you all that information at the end of this hour. Their motto is, let's build. Literally. I love that. So hard. And I just want to also, I just want to close a hoop for myself. When we talk about generate wealth through home ownership, what does that mean? Just describe it.
Well, that's the fastest way to generate wealth in any way that I at least know of. You buy the home, and over time, the market increases, and you're building wealth. And if you hang on to it, and if you take care of it, and if, you know, you can pass it on to another generation, and it gets, you know, I mean, there's people who I've encountered. I think about my parents. They bought their house, their first house, in 1988 for $48,000, and then sold it in 1996 for $190,000. You know, and that's quick, and that's fast, and all they did really is live in it and make it as healthy as possible for their family and upgrade it to, you know, their needs and all that, and came out profitable. So I mean, it's just fast, and it's an easy way. It's not very easy to get to acquire homes now, excuse me. But if you have the privilege to acquire a home, it's just you live in it, you upgrade it, you make it as healthy as possible, you raise your families in it, and you give it to that next generation, and then you set them up.
It also, because it allows you, I'm just going to build on that. It allows you to borrow money to send your kids to college.
Yep.
It has an impact on how much money you even pay in taxes, because there's certain tax breaks you get as being a homeowner.
Absolutely.
Like, in some ways, I'm not going to be the person who comes over and hugs capitalism. I think that capitalism is not a helpful system.
I agree.
I will take a step back and say the idea of what Randall's doing allows people who have been enslaved and oppressed by our society to actually participate in capitalism on something a little more like an even field. And so I know some people that they think money's bad. And in some ways, money is pretty radioactive. At the same time, here we are in society. How do we live together? Are you going to complain to me right now that somebody's living in a tent on your sidewalk? Really? How did that happen?
Right.
How did that happen? And now, having said that, I want to shift gears a little bit and say, I saw your article, your interview with, I want to say that his name is Jonathan Bach. Is it Jonathan Bach? From the Portland Business Journal.
Yeah.
I'm also not the queen of hugging business journal and business organizations, but this guy's cool. I don't know him. I've never met him, but he covers real estate. He covers hedge funds. He covers this stuff, and he's done quite a few stories about how hedge funds buy entire apartment buildings, and they just swallow them up and belch, and then they raise all, and then then the hedge fund raises all the prices and squeezes all of the, what were we just talking about, wealth from that thing, and then they throw it down. I talk a little bit about, so you're actually, you're being interviewed by the Portland Business Journal. It's a great story.
Yeah.
And they're basically holding you up and saying, look at what this guy's doing. What's that like? Like, because some people might think, no, I don't want to talk to the Capitalist Central Committee. I mean, what was it like, though? How are people responding to you who were coming from the business community?
Well, you know, this is actually the second time they did it. They did it a few years ago. I think it's awesome, you know, that they are looking at something like a reparations-based, community-based model as a successful business. You know, because hopefully that will inspire even people from that world to look at philanthropy as something lucrative, as something important to, you know, to their community, to our community, and invest in it. So, you know, that's why I'm willing to talk to this type of publications. I'm really to spread this wherever I can, because that's the whole point, is how can we inspire people and educate people on what's going on, raise awareness in communities that may not even, you know, maybe not agree with it, but maybe, you know, I can share some information that will sway them, or just educate them and realize that the investment actually is worth it.
And that there are people out here with different values.
Exactly.
And they're moving forward with those values, in part to quote, solve, unquote, some of the problems that these straight people are complaining about. I said that, and that was a very complicated statement. I get so tired of people demonizing the folks who live on the street and on the sidewalk, when to me it looks like, and you've heard me say it probably 1,000 times now, that it's the real estate speculation, the property speculation, the home speculation that's actually creating that. And we talk about creating wealth. Property is a major way of creating wealth. And the more our property is sucked up by these already hyper-rich people and hyper-rich organizations, we see more people living on the sidewalk. Portland has more billionaires than ever. Do we need those? Do we need them?
No. That's hoarding. That's hoarding resources. Yeah, and that's the number one thing that has created homelessness is, you know, cost of living, like you said. But we have a society that likes to put the onus on the individual and say it's drugs. And it's, you know, I've worked with the houseless population and, you know, not in a big way, but what I've learned in my little bit of experience with them is a lot of times the drugs come after the houselessness, and makes sense to me, because that reality, it would be tough to deal with sober, if you ask me.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes, you know, I do well, and sometimes my reality can be tough, so it's understandable. Like you're saying,
For people that are listening right now, it's me. It's me, Lisa Loving. So, you know, I've got some rabbit hole that goes deep to the deep past. And this, somehow this whole conversation is reminding me of the Cleo Lillian Social Club, all right? You may have no idea what I'm talking about at all, but the Cleo Lillian Social Club used to be exactly that. It was a social club. I believe it was on North Williams Avenue there in the, I want to say it's in the Concordia neighborhood. And so many people of African descent in the South weren't even allowed to go into local bars. They were completely cracked down on by the police. So what people did was they created social clubs, which is different than a bar. Mm. So people could go in there, they could have their own rules, and it gave them more control to be able to push back on law enforcement. That, you know, this is hard. I'm going to say it too. I guess I've had too much coffee today. But the Oregon Liquor Control Commission and the Portland Police Bureau shut down every Black-owned bar on Alberta Street. And that was one of the things that blighted Alberta Street. Mm-hmm. There were generations of family-owned clubs and bars there that were, completely shut down. And the Cleo Lillian Social Club was essentially shut down by one white woman who complained to the city a million times. Mm. She complained about shootings, right? Oh, they're shootings and they're revving their engines. Okay. And this was a beloved institution in inner Northeast Portland, but there was not one single thing any people of African descent could do in the face of this one white woman with a phone. And I think of that, like, that's the history, but it hasn't changed a bit. It's also the present.
It is.
And it doesn't seem to even matter who is the mayor or who is not the mayor. And by the way, I saw where Neil Goldschmidt passed away this past week in Good Riddance. And that was rude, too, but I said it. I mean, this is the kind of corruption that we have in our city government that people don't really pick up and look at, right?
Absolutely.
And that's real corruption. That's criminal activity. And we live with that. And if you just tuned in, of course, this is Keeping It Real, where Lisa Loving keeps it very, very real.
Mm-hmm. She does. I like that.
Our guest
I'm
is,
learning a lot.
Our guest is Randall Wyatt, founder and director of Taking Ownership PDX, where they help renovate and revive Black-owned homes where owners have requested their help, with an emphasis on enabling Black homeowners to age in place, generate wealth, and simultaneously deter predatory investors and realtors to deflect the gentrification process. Just one more anecdote from the Wayback Machine. Actually, African American people owned significant property mm-hmm. in North and Northeast Portland, and there's multiple ways that the banks, the lending institutions, and somehow I'm just going to say the city of Portland, they had so many traps in dividing especially elders from that property. And there were a couple stories that I didn't even, that were the ones that got away when I worked at the scanner, about people who were in their 80s who lived perhaps in Lake Oswego. Oh, and yes, plenty of Black people live there. Don't even think that. I know what you're thinking right now. Forget that. Anyway, there's plenty of people who don't live in the city, but they own property. And literally, I saw the last real line of ripping those people out of their properties was about taxes. If they didn't pay their taxes, if they were too elderly to even deal with that, the city just moved in and took that property. Mm-hmm. And now that's not the same even as a lending institution taking the property. Okay?
Yeah.
So,
because they can have that house paid off and they still got to pay taxes.
That's exactly right. And so,
you ever really own anything?
And I mean, paying taxes, we want the schools.
I know, we do.
You know, we want that. It's just that I see how the system that has impacted people who are oppressed by the financial lending institution mm-hmm. is a different kind of bear trap. It's different.
It is.
And I you know, so here now, I want to take this little ramp and talk about. Now, this is people who have owned homes, but how does this impact renters too? Like, this must have a big picture take. Why does it matter that our society and our financial institutions, our government forces more Black people to be renters instead of homeowners? Like, what impact does that have on our families and our society? And am I imagining that?
You know, that's a good question. I've actually never had that asks to me what impact it has on renters. I guess what I think this has done is not just my organization focusing on like the Black community in Albina, but others as well, like Albina Vision Trust. You know, they now have gotten a substantial amount of funding to take over, you know, think about that vacant lot in front of Legacy Emanuel.
The actual resources that it would take to do that.
And they're going
to
be able to build affordable housing. Now, there's a lot of conversations because of the awareness that has been raised about building affordable housing and bringing Black descendants of the displaced people from Albina into these communities, which will be huge for renters, for it to be affordable. There's programs like Back Home ADU, actually, that I was their first client, where I got to put an ADU in my backyard and make that affordable housing for people to bring that into this community. And that's going to change the market, and that's going to change the cost of living to hopefully bring it down at some point to where it's affordable for more, you know, marginalized communities. And that's what I'm hoping, you know, and that's what I'm seeing. I'm seeing the planning, at least.
Good, good. What I see there is when the city of Portland creates this complaint driven system where I don't even want to use words, where one neighbor can call and complain about the next door neighbor because there's a dog barking mm-hmm. or there's a garbage can in the driveway or any reason like that at all, it makes it so that there's fewer people who are homeowners. Those people have less ability to do things like pay for college education. You know, they have less ability to create a middle class that other people can aspire to, right, and participate mm-hmm. in. So It just, there to me, I look at it because I'm old now and I see this play out for 20 years and it really blows my mind how I thought we were making the world better and we didn't really. We weren't doing that.
Capitalism, I just don't think it does that. I just think when you operate in a way of competition and individualism and you're not prioritizing community
hoarding.
And wealth hoarding, yep,
right.
And you're not prioritizing community and sharing, it's just, I think it's not sustainable for humanity.
No, it's not. And the other thing that I really wanted to make sure that we talked about before it got too late is that home ownership, the kind of wealth that people can build through home ownership also can help them fund a small business. Like, people can borrow money or they can refinance a thing so that they pay less money and they've got money to create a food cart, a seamstress business, a cafe, a medical transport company. Talk about the work that you do with small businesses. We hadn't had a chance to talk about that.
Absolutely. So, that's kind of a smaller segment of what we do, but we have given out just grants, financial assistance to Black small businesses that need help with paying overhead. Because, some of them are still in the Albina neighborhood or close by, and the cost of renting out their food cart or their brick and mortar is expensive. So we can at least, we haven't brought in a lot. We're very small. I'm the only staff. So we do our best, but we can
you
at least
are mighty.
We at least can help them stay, in the place for another couple months, so they can figure out or buy equipment to upgrade their business, to be more efficient, to serve more people, to scale up. And that's so important. A lot of times you just need a little extra chunk of change to scale your business and get your business to that next level. Maybe it's marketing. We right now we're partnering with the IDA program that called Dev Northwest. Yeah. It's like a match account. So we'll put the initial money into that IDA account. They'll go through a little program where they learn about operating their business, create business models and things like that. And then the IDA program will match that times five. And so we'll put $1,200 in, and by the time they're done with the program, they will have $7,200.
I've lived in Oregon for a long time, and I think that in Oregon, small businesses really are the backbone of every single solitary community, whether you like it or not, whether it's a good backbone or a bad backbone. And there are some bad backbones. But I want to shift gears and just talk about how people support you. And I want a lot of talk right now about being a volunteer, like what you do and who should be showing up for that.
So we've been blessed in that department. We've signed up over 500 volunteers.
What?
Yeah. it's been huge. And they've done a number of things. Primarily, a lot of people didn't want to just write a check and be like, okay, I did my part. They actually wanted to put in some sweat equity. They wanted to come out and meet the Black community. This is the whitest city in America. It truly is. And so as a white person, you can go, a week or days without any meaningful interactions with black people. So this actually gives them an opportunity to meet their Black neighbors, to humanize them, and actually put their effort and time into making tangible results. And actually this has alleviated liens and fines. When some homes, we've had homes that had notices, saying that if you don't clean up your yard, we're gonna put a lien or put a fine, a nuisance fine. Our volunteers have came out, cleaned up their yard for them. We've had volunteers help us get grants. It's really the backbone of what we do. It's just community-based at its finest. And if we didn't have our volunteers, we really couldn't operate. And who can do that? Really, it's anybody. But, obviously, it's Portland, so we're getting mostly allies from the white community.
I think that's beautiful, though.
Yeah.
Because it's giving back.
Yeah.
It's giving back in a tangible way.
Absolutely.
I can't say that we're always easy to get along with or stand next to, but I will say it's a good thing. Really good thing. So are there tasks that you need help with right now that we could just rattle off and have someone? Maybe right now you need someone this weekend who's got a saw blade that can help you do a roof? Is there something right now, an immediate need that we can help you fill?
Well, I'll be honest, it's always funding. Okay. It's always funding. I mean, that's just what's going to keep us afloat. Home repairs aren't cheap. You know, if we want to do any kind of meaningful repairs and improvements to these homes, we got to raise funding. If people are interested in actually joining like a work party, a volunteer project, we have those on our website. You can see it in the volunteer tab. You can sign up there. We also have a community resource list. So if you have an organization or a company that aligns with the work we do, you can submit it on our community resource list. A lot of people utilize it because it actually shows what communities these business owners are from. So it could say LGBTQIA, it could say woman-owned, black-owned, whatever, and people can actually make a choice on what community business, you know, they want to support. There's, you know, spreading the word. Get the word out about what we're doing. You know, and I'd say those are some of the strongest ways to help us. If you know any contractors, any construction companies, vendors that are interested in donating labor or materials, that goes a long way. I mean, that's almost as good as funding. So for what
almost
we're doing,
it's almost as good.
Well, we have operations too, you know, so funding is needed for, you know, right, to pay people. You know,
yeah. My beloved friend Robin Shanti, and I know she's one with the universe right now. She always used to say money is energy. And sometimes people have energy, but they don't have dollars. And sometimes people have dollars and energy, and it's worth it to invest both. It,
very much so.
It's relational. It's about making relationships. So we're starting to run out of show, and I want to ask you, when you look around this town, what do you see?
When I look around this town, what do I see? I see, you know, I've been blessed to start something that got so much support from the city. I see a want for progress, even if we don't always know how to do it or how to get it, what the solution is. But I do see people who are, you know, I'm grateful for this. I get a lot of praise for what I started. I think a lot of people want to find solutions, and I think that's what I see. I just see people who really want to see progress, want to see a thriving community and see their neighbors doing well, at least in where I am in, like what community I am in, you know.
Right. So when you look around the city, you see people doing great things. I see people doing amazing things all over this town. Yeah. Are there places in your experience that you've been traveling through?
And I'll even say, I mean, I see it even on like you know, in the city, and a lot of government people, politicians reach out to me wanting, and I know there's so much bureaucracy and so much red tape, so they move at a snail's pace. They even reach out, you know, wanting to know how they can be more equitable and things like that. And maybe it's performative, and sometimes I know it is. But I mean, I'm seeing it on a lot of levels, you know, so.
But they're ringing your bell, but now you know who they are and where
exactly.
they're at.
Yeah.
I mean, now here's one last thing I wanted to ask.
Okay.
As you meet people, you've even met elected officials and their staff. You've met people who have their own ideas. You've met families who you're helping. For people who do have a dream of creating a community project, or they don't know what they want to do, they just know they want to help, are there places, areas in our region, not just geographical areas, but activism areas that you think people's participation can be particularly impactful? Where should people be running to help?
Grassroots organizations.
Every
that's
kind.
Grassroots all day. That's where you're going to get that quick, tangible results. They're going to be on the ground really working with the populations. They're not going to be waiting for permission to make impact. You know, we ask for, you know, we don't even ask for forgiveness. What I'm saying, we just do the work. So I would say grassroots all the way. Don't wait to be an expert on the subject to get out there, and you can learn while you're going. But for me, I always say, go grassroots. Don't wait for our politicians to create some policy to help something. To get with the people that are on the ground.
All right. Now, one last time. How can people support your work? How do they reach you? What do you need the most? I know we just said that, but let's say it again and again.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you can go to takingownershippdx.org. That's where you can learn all about us. We're still updating the website, actually planning on doing some big updates today. But you can go there and learn all about, you know, what our work is. You can donate directly to us there now that we're a nonprofit since February. You could sign up to be a volunteer. You can submit your company, organization to the community resource list. Yeah, there's lots of ways to get involved.
Excellent. And that is it for our show. This is Keeping It Real with Lisa Loving. Thanks again to our guest, Randall Wyatt. Connect with him online at takingownershippdx.org. Special thanks to KBOO Public Affairs Director Ender Black and Program Director Asia Hawthorne for making this all possible. KBOO Community Radio is open and the airwaves are waiting for you. Get involved by emailing volunteer@kboo.org. Really, thanks for all the people who contributed at our membership drive too. You guys make it happen. This is a do-it-yourself revolution, and there you were. You're in the driver's seat. You can still make a contribution to support programming like this at KBOO. Give us a text. Text KBOO to this number, 44321. And don't forget, you should be here. You should be on the air. Email volunteer@kboo.org. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Into listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio couldn't do it without you. Support KBOO by becoming a member during our Wake Up the Neighbor.